Today's episode of The Thriller Zone is sponsored by Blackstone Publishing and the brilliant new techno thriller 4 Minutes by the number one internationally best-selling author duo, Brian Andrews and Jeff Wilson. 4 Minutes is available now from your favorite bookseller.
Hello and welcome once again to The Thriller Zone. I'm your host, David Temple, and today's special guest is Christopher Swan, best-selling author of A Fire in the Night. I'll hold all the preamble and simply say this guest is a genuinely nice fella, a smart teacher, and this interview will reward you with some tasty morsels of insight and advice, especially if you're an aspiring writer. So let you and I get in the thriller zone. Well, I'll tell you, I've been looking forward to this ever since we first connected, which was...
I can't remember if it was Mark Westmoreland or... Somebody said, hey, this guy is, you know, I'm doing an interview with this guy and looks like it's going to be good. It's before the interview, said, it looks good. Yeah. it's a great book.
A violent gospel. It is. We've become, I don't know if you'd call us pen pals, text pals. he's just that kind of guy.
Yeah. Well, I've got this, he edited collection. That's how I met him through Brian Panowich, another writer. And he, got me involved. I said, can I get in on this? And I had no idea who all was going to be in it until they said, sure, come on in. And by the way, Sean Cosby and Michael Ferris Smith and Brian Panowich and, you know, Mark Westmoreland, Nikki Dolan, like what? I think I've joined the wrong group. Like, no, you're welcome. Come on in. So that was good.
Oh my gosh. That's like a who's who of, it's not really flash fiction. I guess it's novella. They're primarily novella writers. Is that right?
Most of the guys in this that I know of, I think Mark Westmoreland is writing, violent gospels and novella, but Brian Panowich is a friend of mine who writes full-length novels. Sean Cosby, Razorblade Tears and Blacktop Wasteland.
Yeah.
And he's so good and he's so humble. And he's just like a regular person who, by the way, knows how to write really, really well.
Isn't it nice when you run across guys who are really monstrously talented and yet they don't walk around like they know that they are?
Right. I've been lucky in this, this writing career of mine, which is only a few years old now, but in terms of being published, put that way. And all the, I know there must be jerks out there. And I've heard a couple stories, but the vast majority of people I've met, other authors, have been nothing but kind and generous. I mean, I had to, my first book, I'm like, how do blurbs work? How do y'all get blurbs? And they're like, actually, you go get them. I'm like, what? I know one or two people, but okay. So it was almost like cold calls. I was like, hi, I'm your friend on Goodreads. Would you mind? I have a novel. Would you mind reading? And every single author I asked for that first book said yes, except one who said, I would like to say yes, but my TBR pile is like this high. And I know if I say yes, I'll disappoint you. And I won't get to it in time. And I'm so sorry. I appreciate that. So
I appreciate the honesty, right?
Yeah. It's a good community. At least I've found it to be that way so far. So,
yeah, everyone is so giving and so. It's funny because my first job was radio, and it is a cutthroat business. Everybody's out for number one. They'll talk to you like they're your best friend, but no, they're hoping that you'll fail so that you can so they can get your job.
Right, and well, that's the kind of thing with writing. It's not like a zero sum game. It's not like, oh man, Sean's book is number one, is doing really well, or is a bestseller. Like people buy more than one book at a time.
Right.
And I mean, if you get on like the, who's going to be in the top 10, is it going to be, James Patterson and Stephen King are going to be duking it out for who's number one. Okay. That's a whole different level of problem. But for most of us, it's just, okay, we want to write really good stories. We hope people connect with them. And by the way, you should read this other guy's stuff or this other woman's stuff because it's awesome. It's not like I win, you lose. It's we both win. Or I hear it, we've all had that happen to us. Where, went to the bookstore and two people showed up and one of them runs the bookstore. So yeah, that's happened.
Oh my God. I remember my very, very first book signing of my self-published book way back when. And I think it was literally six people and five of them were my family.
Yeah.
By the way, it's Christopher Swan here on the Thriller Zone. I didn't start off with that, but you're going to know it by the end of it. Chris, again, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
First of all, you gotta pardon me. I'm coming off of a cold and it just will not leave me alone. So it's going to pop up every once in a while.
No worries.
The book, A Fire in the Night. Oh, wait a minute. Where are my props? Hi. Along with the matching bookmark.
Gotta get some book swag in there. Yeah.
The cover alone, it reminds me of, and we're going to get to this in a minute. I've got family up in Hendersonville and the Asheville area. And then my sister's building a place over in Marion. So I know what this kind of represents, that chalet look. And the minute I saw it, I was like, oh, I could practically smell chimneys burning up in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
Yeah.
And you capture that, which we'll come back to. I wanted to come out with this couple of things. It arrived, I think, Monday morning. Yeah. I sat down, which is fine. I do like a little bit more prep, but it was a loss, hitching the giddy up.
Thanks to the post office. Sorry about that.
No worries. Anyway, I picked it up on Monday afternoon, and I literally got up this morning about 5:30, and I had to finish it. It was riveting. So I got up and finished it about 2 hours ago.
Oh, thank you for that.
Well, I'm often accused, generally by myself, that I am prone toward hyperbole. I don't know if that's because I'm a wannabe writer or I'm an entertainer by craft, being radio and TV and film.
I was going to say, you're in radio. That's sort of part of the gig.
You got to make things a little bit bigger than they are sometimes. But
absolutely.
I do also want to be the guy that calls it like it is outside of, I mean, if a book really sucks and I'm going to have you on the show, I'm probably not going to say, geez, your book sucks.
Like, so what was it like to write a terrible story? Right. I mean, yeah.
That's even better.
Did you learn how to spell when you were 15 or what happened? Yeah.
David, did your parents ever tell you that you, and don't take this the wrong way, but you have zero imagination?
Don't take this the wrong way. It's like, that's, I'm out. Like, just walk away from the interview right then.
Yeah. It's either that one or, with all due respect. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But all of that said, and I suppose some of it comes from getting caught up in the excitement of meeting an author that you have always wanted to meet, or a new author that you're hoping to help launch their career in any way that you can, or just nerves because maybe I'm intimidated by someone with such an incredible talent. But I'm going out on a limb and saying this book, literally, and I don't think I've said this yet on the show, and I'm going to get some heat for it, but this is a perfect book.
Ah. I paid him well, ladies and gentlemen.
No, I'm not a professional reviewer, Chris, but, and here's why I say that. There's so many reasons. At first few pages, I'm like, oh, this cat's a literary fiction guy. He's a literary author. Where's my pipe, Mussy? You know, and then you get into it and you're like, no, this is a little bit of an action movie. Then it meanders down this path of family and loyalty and love. And then it returns to that page-turning thriller that you literally, you can't put it down.
Ding, 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 ding. That was my goal. So thank you.
Yeah, and I won't keep going on about that. But folks, if you do not pick this book up, I'm just going to say this, and read it, and you'll read it in probably 2 days, then you're really missing out. It does make me, and I don't have the time, generally speaking, because of all the books I'm reading, but it does make me want to go back and read your earlier work.
I wouldn't be adverse to that at all. Thank you for that. I wanted to, the first two books I wrote were first-person narratives, and So, which is great, but you're stuck in the head of one character. And I was started this story somewhat the same way in the main character Nick's head, but I wanted to try to do something else. And once Annalise, his niece, who he doesn't even know, they meet in this book, showed up, I was like, nah, I gotta hear her. I can't do first person here. So I pulled out and did like a third, you know, you hear from Nick and then you kind of float over and you're in Annalise's point of view. And then there's a third one, Cole, who we can talk about later. But I kind of want to just write an old fashioned thriller as best I could, where you think you know the characters, and as the story goes on, wait, this guy is not exactly what I thought he was. So to hear you say that, I appreciate it so much. That's awesome.
Well, and Chris, I'm not saying it to flatter you, I promise you, but it's interesting that you should say that exact phrase, because that's one of the things I really enjoyed. And you did it so masterfully. You're like, oh, Nick Anthony's this guy. Oh, wait a minute. He's not quite that. He's a little bit more. Okay, but I got him now. And then a little bit later, you're like, oh no, Nick is a little bit of this. And the way that it unpeeled like an onion was just amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, that's something I wanted to try to do. I actually got kind of annoyed because a couple early reviews jump right to about halfway through the book or wherever, where you sort of realize some of Nick's backstory. And some thanks, you know, thanks guys for doing that. But who reads reviews? No, it's something I've always liked those stories. And I know they've been done a lot, where you think you know the character and there's a secret past and that sort of thing. And I wanted to see if I could pull it off and do it in a way that wasn't cliche and wasn't just the same old, same old. And I wrote it as best I could. I mean, I'm not trying to write Ulysses here.
Right.
Yeah, you want to take as much care with it as you can. And you want to tell a good story that with a good character that people read and go, you know, I want to find out more about this guy. I'm going to follow him down whatever kind of path. If you can do that as a writer, it doesn't really matter what kind of story you're writing, romance, sci-fi, right? Action, adventure, thriller. If you got a character that a reader's like, you know, I'm going to spend some time and follow this person around, then yeah, that's gold for a writer.
Mission accomplished. And speaking of Annalise, the niece that he didn't know, talking about another layered character. You think she's just a whiny little bitch at one point and, you know, spoil a little rotten. And then you realize, yeah, man, what she's just lost. And I want to be real careful not to give it away. I don't think it's too much to give away to say that her parents were killed in a fire.
Yeah. Yes.
And there's somebody looking for her. So let's just leave it at that. But the fact that she was able to morph, and by the end of the story, I'm like,
yeah,
wait a minute, do we have a new super heroine on our hands?
I mean, if Nick and Annalise showed up in a future book, I was offered the opportunity to do that, I wouldn't say no. They were a lot of fun, having them spark off of each other. It's, you know, you've got the older middle-aged, you know, the middle-aged guy who's just sort of like grieving the loss of his wife and just sort of shutting out the world. And that's chapter one, y'all. So I'm not giving too much away. And then you've got the 16-year-old girl who he doesn't know who shows up. That was part of how this story started. I had the idea of a character like Nick, and then, you know, because it's a novel, I can't have him just sit in his cabin and grieve for too many pages. And, you know, boom, this, I had this idea of a teenage girl just stumbling onto his porch. And the story kind of went from there, but yeah, she was a lot of fun to write. And I wanted to do her justice. You know, I wanted to see if this middle-aged guy could pull off a 16-year-old female character. And
you did. And of course you've already jumped ahead to one of the things I was going to say is, and I know you're probably working on the next book with something else, because these have been standalones, it seems to be, to me, from the research I've done. But it does beg the question, and I got to ask it because it's logical. I'm like, there's got to be a sequel somewhere, because it's concluded, It's not a perfect bow, but it's enough of a conclusion that you feel satisfied. But there's so much of an opportunity that if you wanted to keep it going, it would be so easy to do.
That's what I wanted to do to see how well this went. Initially, I thought it would be a standalone, but while I was writing it and I came to love these characters and how they kind of sparked off each other, I realized, you know, the stories might not be completely done. My second book, Never Turn Back, up here over my shoulder, the book I'm working on now that my editor has a draft of in her hands is a sequel to that. And I'm dabbling in idea of maybe a series. We'll see what happens.
Let me see if I get this straight. So Never Turn Back came out October of last year, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Shadows of the Lions was your debut, right?
It's my debut in 2017.
Here's an interesting question. I got so many. You be the judge of interesting. One of the things I liked about this is going to sound kind of weird, maybe. It's not a backhanded compliment. It's a front-handed compliment. It's only 278 pages.
Yeah.
Which for me is a little gift in of itself in that I feel like I can go through this pretty quickly. I'm getting a lot of books in the 350 approaching four, or even 450 approaching five. And, and there's so much backstory and so forth, which is all great in of itself. But this one, maybe the brevity at 278-ish made for a quicker read. It's like this. You did everything you needed to do. You said everything you needed to say. You brought in really great characters from a world of different backgrounds. You told a poignant story that revealed a lot of depth and a lot of different characters. So it's kind of like mission accomplished. Would you want to stretch it out to 350? Sure, but why do so, right?
Right, exactly. I think the Never Turn Back was, you know, first book, Shadow of the Lions, and I'd worked on that for a while, and that was my debut, and was amazing, got a great reception. I was like, okay, I've arrived as a writer. And I don't mean that in some sort of fat-headed, I'm amazing kind of way. I was just like, okay, now I have done that, and now when I can keep doing it, that's great. So now there was a part of me, I thought, this is fantastic. You know, I know what I'm doing now. Then I sat down at my laptop and the second book was like, yeah, that's really cute. That was your first book. This is a whole different thing. And writing Never Turn Back was one of the harder things I've done in my life. And at one point it kind of swelled and got really big. I had a really good editor who came in and said, okay, here's what I think you're trying to tell. And so here's what I would suggest you move this here and take this out. And she was absolutely right. There are times when you want a 500 page book or you need that space. Right. But there are times when, you know, you get to where you're, and you're like, okay, I think the story's done. If I add anything else to it, it's just going to be padding and it's just going to slow it down. Or it's going to be repetitive or whatever. So, you know, I got to where it's entertaining. You feel like it's a good enough story to, you know, frankly, warrant the expense and the time, because, you know, reading takes time and people have got only so many hours in the day. So they're going to spend some of it with a book I've written. I'm going to try to make it the very best book I can. So
that is really well put. And, you know, that one you're talking about, Never Turn Back, it really came in only 10 pages longer, but you made an interesting point. A lot of people, I'll be reading a book and I'll think, there's a great big chunk, and boy, has my wife helped me really gain this when she starts to read my very first draft before I get busy on it. She said, and it's a classic line that I told her that she loves to throw back in my face, is that, well, David, does it progress the story forward? But it's true. If all of a sudden you're reading it and you're like, it doesn't really take it forward, and it only feels like a kind of plumping up of something you said over here. So let's just cut that out and see if we miss anything. And 9 times out of 10, you don't.
Right. My wife, Kathy, does this. She reads everything that I write, and she gives very honest feedback, which the longer that's gone on, the more I've come to appreciate it. Earlier on, I think I was like, I know what I'm doing. I wrote this great. She's always right. Simple's best. You want to complicate things if you're writing a story with any kind of mystery, but keep it simple, stupid. Still is a good operating program.
You know, complication doesn't always mean
in depth and more drama or more character analysis. No, sometimes complicated just means wordy.
You have to try and fail at something like that. And then if you can say, all right, but at least I finished a book-length story, so yeah. I know how to do it. Now I'm just going to go do it.
Yeah.
Well,
something's burning here, a hole in my hand, because you said something that made me think of this gentleman twice. Ted Bell was on the show, and he was so good. And he was friends with neighbors and friends with James Patterson. Anyway, so he says this. He's out on the golf links with James, and they're wrapping the game. And he goes, you know, listen, thank you so much for all this help that you've done on this book, blah, blah, blah. And James, well, yeah, but here comes the hard part. What's that? Your next book. Mm-hmm. Shot out of the gate with this winner, but you got to do this again. And you can't just do a rehash of the first success. You got a whole new mountain to climb, and you got to kick ass. And he's like, wow, it was daunting.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, you're right, and you have this dream of one day I shall see, you know, a book that I've written on a shelf in a store somewhere, or I'll see somebody. You have like a sighting in the wild, we kind of jokingly call it. You'll see somebody you don't know reading your book. And like, okay, I have made it. But then, okay, that now it's the next. That's good. Now what are you going to do next? What have you done for me lately? kind of thing, right? And so it is daunting, but the nice, if you're going to write stories, you're already an optimist, and you're already stubborn if you've stuck at it for any length of time. Because no one gets into this business for like instant success. I mean, that happens, but
yeah.
When I was 13, when I knew I wanted to write stories, and I looked, I'm like, what do writers do? Even then, I knew writers weren't like, well, I finished that book. Now I'm going to retire to the beach, and maybe next year, if I need to fill my coffers with some more cow, I'll write another one. Yeah, I want to get I want to buy a yacht. Maybe I'll write another book. If you like telling stories and you stick with it long enough and you're stubborn enough about it, then things will happen. That faith in storytelling has kind of carried me through. Even when I struggled with writing, even when I struggled with, okay, I don't know what I'm doing with, what are words? Like, I don't even, how did I write the first book? I have no idea how this works. Yeah, you do. Just take a breath and start over.
Yeah. Don't freak yourself out. We put a lot of that pressure on ourselves, and it's, look, if you've already done one and you had great success with it, you know the ability is there, or you've done, in your case, three, working on four. You can drive the car. You don't have to worry about, can I parallel park and see the rearview mirror all at the same time? Yes, you can. Just get into it. I do want to drill down on this, because I find this fascinating, and maybe it's because I don't have the degree of education that you do, but and it also shares a little parallel universe with you and I. You graduated from a private all-boys school in Madison County, Virginia. I grew up in a little town, Lynchburg, Virginia. Oh, yeah. You earned a BA in English from Washington and Lee. Mm-hmm. I got a BA from a little place called Liberty University. And then you went on to get an MA in English and Creative Writing from Missouri Columbia, which is a whole nother thing. Then you got a PhD in creative writing from Georgia State University, where you now live in that area. I hope that's a good question. What was the biggest gain that you got from getting both an MA and a PhD in writing? I mean, besides the obvious of you being a hell of a writer, I mean, that notwithstanding.
I appreciate that. I joked earlier about, I was 13, knew I wanted to be a writer. What do writers do? And that, well, they teach. And a lot of them are teachers. And I thought, okay, at 13, I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And that was the beginning and end of my sort of career, thinking about my career goals. It's like, I want to write books and I want to teach to pay the rent. And that didn't really change through high school and college. And then I stumbled into teaching and realized, okay, this isn't just a way to pay the bills. I actually love this. I knew that I needed to get another degree. You get a little bit bump in salary and you get taken a little bit more seriously if you're looking for jobs. And that was the MA. Plus, I'd just gotten married and my wife was going to get a PhD in psychology. And so we applied together. And luckily, it turns out we went to Missouri. I wanted to get the PhD more just, that was more, I just wanted to see if I could do it. It wasn't because now everyone shall call me doctor or whatever.
Right.
But what I got the most, I was in, other than having access to some really amazing teachers, which I did, I got to, in creative writing programs, you get to work with other people who have a similar dream as you, which is to spend an awful lot of time, a lot of waking hours and some sleeping hours, talking to people who don't exist outside of your own head and trying to get them on paper and have other people read them so they get them stuck in their heads. It's a bizarre thing if you think about it that way. And writers, you spend, I mean, at the end of the day, it's you alone with your laptop or your legal pad or whatever.
And some places you would be put into a very strongly secured building for that.
Yes. Very comfortable padded room. And so it's kind of nice to talk to other people who would be in this, who'd be inmates in the same asylum, if you want to extend that metaphor. And you see other people are wrestling with the same kinds of things, and you meet people who are better than you and who sort of who challenge you to raise your game. I will say about creative writing programs, I know one of the criticisms of them is, and I've said this before, is that people who go through creative writing programs learn to write really well about not very much. And there can be a kind of, it's not really true, but there's a tiny bit of truth to that, or it could be, to where if you can get too sort of precious, and you were joking earlier about literary fiction. Well, that's sort of what people are trying. If you're writing fiction in creative writing workshops, that's sort of the goal. If you're trying to write anything that's genre, whether it's, again, sci-fi or romance or thriller, that and plot are sort of, in my experience, that's not really all as that important compared to character and description. And they're right about the character. And if you're going to describe something, you want it to come across really well. But that the exaggerated version is that of that is the 3-page description of the feather bed or whatever.
Right.
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 Where you're basically just sort of impressing yourself as a writer. I think I learned how to proofread. I learned, I had a whole story. I spent 25 minutes. The teacher spent 25 minutes. Now, this story was pretty good, but she used a whole lot of adverbs and spent 25 minutes in workshop in front of all my peers talking about, so you don't really need that one. And then went through every, you know, you're like, I should quit now and just leave. And no, she was doing me a favor.
Sure.
It's that, but it's mostly you meet other people who want to write and who give you honest feedback. That's what you need as a writer.
Sure.
Everybody needs you need your friends. You need people who are going to say, this is amazing. You're the best writer ever. You know, congrats. When's the next book coming out? We all need that. But we also need, you know, this scene is boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't get this at all. What are you trying to do here? So that's the biggest thing you get out of like creative writing programs is peers who are going through the same thing you are and who give you honest feedback.
Well, there's a few sentences and I caught it early on. I'm not going to go back and dig it up, but there, it would be the way you would form a phrase that you don't necessarily speak that way, but when you read it, it makes so much sense. And it's a truncation. You're saying it and then you truncate part of it so that you're kind of jettisoning forward to be able to get the point made without actually just going on and on and blah, 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 blah. And I liked it, but it was clearly, you could tell that you'd spent some time in literary work. So it's still kind of a compliment. It's still a compliment. It's just, but then when you get into what I call the classic thriller of, especially when you got down to the chase scenes and then you were compressing time down near the end, I was like, wow, this fella can flat out get the thrill on. That's when you know.
I've read a lot of books like that, and we've all read books that start that way and then they don't. Kind of like when you watch, if you watch a trailer for a movie, you're like, that looks amazing. And you go watch the movie and you realize all the best parts of the movie were in the trailer.
Or as my wife says, yeah, we've just watched the movie.
Honestly. Yeah, and I can tell he's the bad guy. They're going to end up together. And, you know, here's the solution. You're like, and you're probably right. Yeah. I thank you again for the compliments and the writing. I think that I knew I wanted to try to cycle around with these three different characters in this book. And as I got, you know, I do a chapter, Nick, and then Annalise, and then Cole, who's one of the people who's looking for Annalise. I didn't want to spend too much. I wanted to focus on Cole some, but didn't want to spend too much time in him, keep him mostly off stage as a threat. But as we get near, the third act of the book, I started cycling between them, jumping a bit more, and realized, okay, that's either going to confuse people if I don't do it well, or it's going to ramp up the tension. And working with my editor, we got it down. So we got it as taut as I could. And it was a lot of fun trying to make that work.
That's a good question. Let's call it 290. And you said it was kind of fatter at one time. What is the editing process and a good editor really kind of the magic potion to getting that book to the point where you really are doing this and you're not just belaboring things? And that part one, part two is, how much longer was the book? This is pure curiosity because I love to break down and analyze a book.
For this book, actually, my second one, Never Turn Back, was that was probably 50 pages longer, and we had to cut it down at 40 pages. This one, actually, my editor said, I think we need a little bit more, because it was maybe, and I knew it was about 20 pages shorter than it is now.
Okay.
And I wasn't sure in that early draft. Like, I think I know where to add things, but I'm kind of worried about, again, I don't want to just pad stuff. Or having a really good editor is helpful. A lot of people think editors are
hatchet.
They're hatchet, or they want you to totally change the whole. Like, my first book is a mystery set in an all boys boarding school. And friends of mine seem to have this idea that an editor is like, yeah, the story is great, and could you do that, but in space? Right? Or what if we made it an all girls school? Like, and that's not what editors do. They're telling you, like, this, I don't know if you need the secondary character, or this scene is repetitive, or this is, you know, here's what you're doing well. Here's this character arc that's great. I might suggest moving this scene here because I think it'll be more effective if you put it over here. Mostly they're they see the story in a way that you can't, because as the writer, you're kind of too close to it. So they're an outsider reading it. A really good editor knows exactly what you're trying to do and has the perspective to help you get to where you want the story to be, even if you don't know that's what you need at first.
Right.
You're like, I think it's done. Like, no. You don't need to end there. You need to end here.
Yeah.
Do I really need to? Yeah, you do. And if they're good, they're right. That is helpful. Yeah. Really good editors, no, not any kind of a hatchet.
Yeah. How did you find your editor? And is it the same editor on all three books?
No, first book, Shadow of the Lions, was with Algonquin. And funny story, not so funny. Right after my agent sold it, she called and said, look, I'm getting hired away by a different agency and I can't take you with me, but I'm going to hand you off to one of my colleagues who's really interested in your fiction. And that is, my current agent, Peter. But for a few months, I was sort of in limbo. We were trying to figure that out. While that happened, my editor at Algonquin, who had finished editing the story, we just had copy edits left. She said, hey, I just got hired away by Ballantine. And so, but you have to stay here with the publishing house. I can't take you with me. And I'm not really sure who your editor is going to be. So for a few months, I didn't have one. I didn't have an editor or clearly have an agent. So that felt great.
Oh,
it's called being orphaned. Yeah. Right. And then, Crooked Lane, I got on with Never Turn Back, and got Jenny Chen, who edited that. And then she edited A Fire in the Night. And then she got hired away by Ballantine. And so now I have my third editor, Terry, who's great so far. So that's interesting. But having it's having a good relationship with and being able to trust the person who you're working with. And it's kind of hard because first book was in 2017. I didn't meet my first editor, Andra, in person until after Shadow of the Lions came out. And I didn't meet, not in person. It was all, she's in New York. And so it was all phone calls and email. And Jenny, my editor for the next two books, we never met in person. In fact, my wife saw that she's coming to a conference here in Atlanta later next year. And it's like, you ought to reach out and see if you guys can grab coffee or something. It's a weird thing to have that kind of a relationship with somebody with your books. And you're like, don't share the same physical space. I guess we're getting more used to that now with COVID and, I've become very intimate with Zoom as a school teacher. So, it is what it is.
This might be a really good place to insert this question that I probably was going to filter down later. And that is, knowing what you know now, with the education and prowess that you've achieved, what would be the best advice you would offer writers today, whether they're, brand new up and comers, whether they're self-publishing or traditional publishing, or wondering, do they have another one in them, or et cetera?
The main thing I would say is don't give up. Do not quit. And that sounds easy to say, but, like I said, I wanted to write since I was 13. And I don't know if you can tell looking at me, but 13 was a while ago. And I,
don't be so hard on
this. I didn't spend the entire time from then until now, like slaving away at my craft or what have you. Life gets in the way. You have children, you have a job, and you're like, I'd rather watch this movie than work on my whatever. And, but there were so many times where I could have just said, I've tried this thing. I'm happily married. I've got two kids. I have a nice house. I have a job I love and enjoy. I've got health insurance. Things are good. If I walked away from this, no one would, people would not fault me. But I would have. And I got just enough encouragement at certain points in my career, people saying no, but you've got anything else you're working on, or stick, you should keep doing this. What have you? Because there are so many people out there who are good writers and they try, and it's such a subjective business. You want to have some people read my first book, and I got two reviews saying, the beginning of this just takes off like a bullet, and then it slows kind of way down. I wasn't sure about that. The very next review I read said, man, it has a slow burn start, but then it just takes off like a rocket. I'm like, did y'all read the same book? And if you've had outside of blood relatives or friends who are supposed to tell you you're an awesome writer. I'm lucky enough to have a spouse who, she thinks I'm a great writer, but she also calls me on it when I don't do well, and I need that. But if you have anybody like that, or a stranger, anyone who's read something you've written and has given you positive feedback, and you really want to tell stories, and you're going to tell them whether or not you sell them or not, stick with it. Don't quit. The only reason I'm a published author, aside from whatever talent I have, and there are a lot of people who have a lot of talent and a lot more talented writers out there than me, the only reason I'm published is because I didn't stop, and I could have so easily. And now I've got three books and a fourth coming out. So
there's the soundbite, baby.
Yep. I mean, I'm the proof's in the pudding, man. And if you're going to stick with this business of writing stories, then, be prepared for the long haul. And again, you never know. It took me forever to find an agent. I got an agent and who said, send me this. I've read the first out. This is great. Send me the rest of it. And I did. And then she promptly went on maternity leave. And yep. So 6 months of her office is like, oh, she's still reading it, but the baby. And I'm like, yeah, that's great about the baby.
Yeah.
And you can't be like, I don't care about your stupid baby, because first of all, because that's not true. And also it's incredibly rude, but you're like, do you like the book? And then, You finally get the
yes or no.
I finally finished the book. You know, yeah. I loved it. Let's talk. And, you know, I remember getting that email. My wife and I got the email on vacation. We were in Ireland on vacation. We got that email and I was like, oh my God. And I got my high school English teacher. I cried everything, but I got teary eyed and my wife cried. And, so yeah, it's dream come true. And I'm just lucky that, you know, how many people have a dream where it's been 30 some years, man. Right. And then it comes true.
Yeah.
And you get to see that. And yes. Then you can keep doing it, you know, knocking wood, at least so far. So,
you know, I'm going to do a side move here. I am a big, we're going back to blurbs. I'm a big fan of blurbs, and you got Sean Cosby on here, which by the way, since you guys are pals, please put in a word for me. Cause I really want him on the show. You got Alex Segura. You've got, Brian Pano, which one of your fans, and I know, Mark loves him as well.
Oh yeah.
It's the one on the front. And I was lucky to have this gentleman as my, I think, was it number two? My second guest on the Thriller Zone, Lee Goldberg, New York Times bestselling author, I might add. Mm-hmm. He says, and this is where I went, I have got to read it now. Literary fiction, comma, a spy novel, comma, and a relentless thriller all in one. And I went, okay, if this cat can really pull that off, I'm all in. And you did. You got the lit, you got the spy, you got the thriller. And just once again,
I saw that and I got that blurb and I sent it to my editor and said, you know, holy crap, this is what I've been trying to do for three books. This is what I'm trying to hit. Yeah. And
the trifecta.
Yeah. I met Lee and we were at a writing conference in Alabama a couple years ago before the pandemic hit. And he's a really funny writer, really funny guy, has all, I'm sure on your part, all kinds of stories about writing for Hollywood. And oh, yeah. He wrote for all of these TV shows in the 80s. You know, he wrote for Sequest and he was having us all the other writers were all dying laughing because he's writing about meeting with some producer about a scene where the dolphin in Sequest, who is like really intelligent, like can talk through computer characters, and the producer's like, you don't understand the pain the dolphin has gone through. And Lee is like sitting here listening to this guy, like screaming him about a talking dolphin. And we're all just laughing our heads off. And at the same time, you know, I've read his first Eve Ronan book and he's on, I think, number four right now. And it's like, okay, yeah, I knew this guy could write. This is good. And yeah, again, I reached out to him. So would you be willing to read? He's like, sure, send me a copy. And he sent that back to me. And I was like, I'm going to frame this and hang it up over my desk.
I would. He is an amazing guy. Super nice. So approachable. It's so unaffected. Yes. I was like, how can you be so unaffected having done all you've done? And then I realized that when you hang around guys that are real true pros and are comfortable in and of themselves and with themselves, that confidence burns of, yeah, I know, I got it, but it's not ego. It's just like, yeah, but we don't need to talk about that. Let's talk about the talking dolphins. You know, I love that.
Yep.
So back to our location. So, you know, I was born in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, grew up in Lynchburg, mm-hmm. and then years later moved to Charlotte to be near family, and then family up in Asheville. And this is the reason I bring that up is because it brings this phrase. When I was reading this and as I grew closer to the end, I was like, this was like going home again. And all the nostalgic of the small town of Cashiers and the yeah. and the lodge and the smoke and the snow and the pads. And I've done all the hiking through the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I think suppose that was part of that palpable attraction that I gained with this story. But it really does give you that sense. And what I wanted to know is how did this handsome education of yours and growing up in and around those parts, how did that influence you? Was it just logical that, oh, well, I grew up here and I'm going to talk about it? I noticed you mentioned that first book being about all boys school, which yeah. was your first school. Yeah. What do you think about that?
Well, I think the advice you get early on as a writer is write what you know. Right. And like a lot of writers, I wanted to, you do one of two things. Either you write stories that are thinly veiled autobiographical accounts of your own life, or you go try to go in the opposite direction and write about stuff you have no idea about, but you try to fake it. And I chose B. I chose the second. And that didn't always, that was a lot of fun, but didn't always work out very well. And I realized after writing my first book, my wife had said, why don't you try writing something you know? And, you know, so you went to boarding school, so the story in a boarding school, people like those. And so I tried that and it pulled it off pretty well. I realized I can just sort of steal stuff from my own life, use what I want and ditch the rest. And I grew up in North Carolina. I was born in Asheboro, moved to Morganton, lived in Winston-Salem, lived in Asheville. My dad was a banker with Wachovia. We moved all around the state. Then we moved down to Atlanta. But my mom's parents lived in Cashers. Granddad was a World War II veteran. And when he got out of the Navy, served in the Pacific, he came home, met my mom, who was 2 years old, had been born while he was overseas. And my mom apparently told him, you're not my daddy. That's my daddy. And pointed a picture of my grandfather in his uniform that my grandmother had. And, you know, my grandfather's heart was broken. They were in Tryon, North Carolina, and they went up into the mountains for a picnic. And my mom let my grandfather put a flower in her hair, and he turned to my grandmother and said, Dot, we're moving here. And I was a little more involved than that, but that's the family story. And here was Cashers. In 1948, there was one stoplight. And, you know, I mean, Cashers really only has about 6,000 people live there year round.
Yeah.
But now it's full of all kinds of vacation homes and such, and the area's gotten kind of built up. But they moved up there, ran a gift shop out of the front of their house, and eventually built a house next door, turned the whole first house into the store, 50 years of that. It was the first gift shop up there. You go up there now, you can't throw a rock without hitting a gift shop or a boutique of some kind. And when I told you that this story, I had this older guy and this middle-aged guy is in his house, teenager runs on the porch. It was in the mountains in my head. And I'm like, it's gotta be Western North Carolina.
Yes.
I wanted to run up, I'll make it Cashers and Highlands. And I had been to the Highlands, the Hudson Library in Highlands before for my other two books. And I thought, Shadow of the Lions, I didn't do much for Never Turn Back, came out during the year of COVID. Mm-hmm. So no touring there in person anyway. And I was like, this would be a good scene. There's a library fight in A Fire in the Night. And I went up there right after it came out, I went up there for an event and I had a nice crowd and I said something. I said, you know, there's a little altercation in the library. And from the back of the room, the librarian's like, you trashed the library. And I said, I didn't trash anything. The characters can. The main character didn't want to. Anyway, we had a good laugh about it. But I wanted to use that place and I love that area. And I also wanted someplace, honestly, where you didn't necessarily have the best cell phone reception. A lot of writers, starting with Emily Carpenter, is a friend of mine, writes thrillers, Southern Gothic. She's great. And we were complaining about cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, that they solve so many problems, complaining about them as a writer, because they solve so many problems that you put characters in. Like, I don't know how to read Sanskrit, and just Google it.
Yeah. I'm like,
right. I'm lost. I don't know where I am. Hey Siri, where am I?
Yeah. Right? Yeah. You don't have cell reception up in a lot of those mountain towns at all.
No, you don't. I just said that and my phone just started telling me where I'm located out loud.
Tell Siri to shut up.
That's just, I'm afraid to.
Yeah.
That's scary.
All right. Two quick things. First of all, I call it Cashiers, like what you have at a store. So it's Cashiers, and I had a brain fart there. Number two is
that
story that you were telling. I'm like, God, why does that sound so familiar? Isn't that Letty's backstory? One of the characters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In the Carolina Mountain Shop, that was the name. Letty is an alternative universe version of my grandmother. My grandmother was very, very very proper and polite. Although she and my grandfather, they were Yankees. They were from away. She's from New Jersey. He was from Pennsylvania.
Oh yeah.
And it only took him about 30 years to get finally sort of, welcomed into the community. Yeah. She did not have she wasn't salty, my grandmother, in any way. So I changed that a little bit for Letty. And, that was the store.
Yeah.
It was kind of paying homage to them, because I would go work in that store as a teenager. I would go up 13 or 14 in the summer, work for a week or two. And all the girls, my grandfather called them, these local women they would hire to, help in the store. And they would, ruffle my hair. And I'd be like, stop it. But secretly kind of liked it. It was kind of fun to be like the kid. And they didn't, try to wrap presents or ring a customer up or whatever.
Sure.
It was fun. And so I drew on that and put that in there.
I was just sitting there going, wait a minute, I've heard this story. Where have I heard this story? And I'm like, hey, idiot, you just read it.
It's in there, yeah.
All right, before we start wrapping things up, I want to drill back around to this, and I don't know why I'm so obsessed by it, because this just felt like almost the perfect length. And it begs this question, Chris, and I've asked other people this before. With, everyone says, oh, our attention spans are getting shorter, which is why Twitter and Instagram and TikTok are so much more powerful and so forth. And nobody watches videos on YouTube anymore that you used to be 5 to 7 minutes, but no, it's now like 2 to 3 tops. Mm-hmm. And so it begs the question, do you think, two-part question, do you think that in your next book will be in that 3, sub-3, over-3 range, or that crunching in the background is my dog found the bone. And if I don't let him sit here and chew on it, he'll then bang at the door to get in.
I understand completely.
Okay. So do you see that as the future? Do you see that as maybe your future book, but do you also see that as part of the potential future of books to come because of this massive influx of media that we're getting, and people are turning to audiobooks so that they can do one or two things while reading audibly mm-hmm. the book?
I don't know. I don't think that, people have been talking about the near future demise of the book for a long time.
Yeah.
They've all been proven wrong. And everyone, you'll get these massive books, Don Winslow, who wrote The Power of the Dog and The Cartel and The Border. Those are riveting books, and they're page turners, but they're also, The Cartel was massive, right? I think it was 400, 500 pages long.
It took me a season to get through. Yeah.
Right. But it's riveting stuff. And I think that if it's written well enough, then you're going to be fine. I think my next book, it'll probably be, it's a little bit longer than A Fire in the Night, but not massive. It's you're hitting around 300.
Got it.
I don't think unless you are writing purely commercially and you're on some kind of a deadline or contractually obligated, or you're writing in a format like, say, mainstream television or something, where you're really like, okay, you got 22 minutes. You got to
write.
I think for me, story is, I'm going to write the story that the character tells me they need. Yeah. I'll have a character and I'll have a situation and see how it unfolds. And I think at this point I've got a pretty decent take on rhythms and on setting up suspense and trying to, reader needs to know something by this point. Something needs to happen by this point. If that comes in at 300 pages, great. If it comes in at 500, I'll double check to make sure that I'm not writing 3 pages about the feather bed.
Right.
But other than that, I think it depends on the writer and the story. I think that people are still willing, even in this day and age where attention spans are short and dragging 10,000 different directions. Got a good story? Okay.
Yeah.
You just want to write the best story that you can. It's going to grab your reader and make them care about the character. And like I said, if they care about the character and they get invested in that character, then they're going to follow that character through whatever you put them through. Unless you blow up the story or the character's life so much that they're just, okay, this is stupid. And they put the book down.
I know you got kids home from school and you got dinner plans here. So let's go ahead and wrap it up. We do this little thing called rapid fire questions. If you heard the show, you probably heard it. The first one's a layup. Keyboard or notepad?
Keyboard.
Coffee, tea, or an adult beverage while writing?
coffee. I'm drinking coffee now. If I adult beverage, then the next day I'll read it and just trash it and start over.
Yeah, kind of like those days in college, maybe for some people. I've read that had a little bit of Puff Puff and they went the next day and go, I have no idea what that means.
Right.
All right. Do you snack or abstain while writing?
I'll snack if I'm hungry.
Gotcha. This one's a little more complicated, but it's one of my favorites. I'm just doing a little twister. If you could have three people over to your house for an afternoon of hanging out by the grill, the pool, cornhole game, whatever your favorite festivity is in there in the backyard. Yeah. You're going to invite three people over, anybody, living or dead. Who would they be and why?
I'm a high school English teacher, so it's highly unoriginal, but William Shakespeare, like, how did you do that?
Yeah.
Not only how did you do that with language, but how did you pull it off again and again and again and sell tickets and be commercially successful while also writing great literature? How did you do that? Pat Conroy, because he lived in my neighborhood here in Atlanta, and I never had the guts to go knock on his door and say, hi, I'd like to be a writer. And everyone who's met him that I've met, other writers are like, he would so have loved that. He would have said something funny and cutting and then smiled and said, come on in. And he would have talked to you as long as you wanted, probably. That would have been amazing. So that's a missed opportunity.
The guy could flat out write.
Oh, yeah. And the third, it's a draw of two very different, either Kate Winslet, because I've always had a crush on her, or and she's an amazing actress, or my grandfather, because he was a great storyteller, and I miss him.
All right, last one. I just get a sense of the very little time we spent together. I know that part of this has gone through your head. So if you could take one of those three books over your shoulder, Shadow of the Lions, A Fire in the Night, or Never Turn Back, take any one of those three and you could get it turned into a film. Maybe you're the executive producer. Either way, somebody comes to you, here's a big fat check. We want to make one of these into the film. Which one would you pick? You get to pick it, Chris, because you're a rock star. And who would play your protagonist in whichever one you chose?
Oh, wow. I'm torn between all of them and Never Turn Back just because I'm writing the sequel to that. But I think it'd have to be A Fire in the Night just because in my head, it's the most recent one. And also in my head, it's, I can see it. I see it unfold.
Dude, it's so chock full of TV series or a movie.
Right. I'm not sure who Nick would be. Annalise, I'd probably want to get some breakout. Sorry, it's funny. I'm a Marvel fan, and my younger son is too. And we've been watching the TV show Hawkeye, and it's got Hawkeye with by Jeremy Renner, middle-aged guy, and then Haley Steinfeld is sort of like the sidekick, this girl, this like super fan of Hawkeye who meets him, and they team up together. But somebody like her to play Annalise. I don't know who would Nick be. Getting him right would be tough.
Folks, if you want to learn more about Chris, go to ChristopherSwan.com. You can follow him on Twitter. I love this. Swanee author. Swanee author.
I thought about changing. That was a nick. Swanee was a nickname I got in college and sometimes in high school. And I was like, yeah, why not? Now it works. So I'll stick with it.
Perfect. Because you know what? You can't forget it and no one else has got it. So.
Right.
Bingo. Chris, thank you so much for this time together. It's really been awesome. I'm so glad we connected.
Me too. David, thank you so much. And thank you all, everybody out there, for watching and listening.
Yeah. And I hope that you'll consider coming around next time. Would it be next year, perhaps? We'll be looking at that sequel, too.
Yeah, sequel to Never Turn Back comes out right now. It's coming out August 9th, 2022. So
nice.
Yep. I'd be happy to come back.
Thank you again, Chris.
Yeah, man. Thank you, David.
Thanks again, Chris. And folks, do yourself a favor and pick up a copy of A Fire in the Night. Make a nice stocking stuffer. Okay, next Friday's show, aka New Year's Eve, promises to be super special. Why? Well, first, because you're going to hear from a super talented, super warm, and superlatively charismatic woman who happens to be my beautiful wife, Mrs. Tammy Temple. And second, because I can't think of anyone better to share my microphone than my super soulmate. On next Friday's show, which happens to be the day after our fifth wedding anniversary, how cool is that? We will revisit some of the highlights of 2021. We'll revisit several of our favorite guests and talk about our favorite thriller reads of the year, as well as several of our favorite thriller TV series and films of 2021. The extra bonus? we'll be recording our show live on the road as we make our way to family across the country. It promises to be lots of fun and fantastically on the fly. I hope you'll tune in. In the meantime, drop us a note to say hello or a quick review on thethrillerzone.com. But most importantly, be sure to take time off and enjoy your family and friends. And then get ready, because we have one heck of a lineup in 2022, beginning with the legendary Ace Atkins, New York Times bestselling author John Gilstrap, the superstar writing duo of Andrews Wilson, and number one New York Times bestselling author of 11 novels in the Grain Man series, coming soon to Netflix and starring Ryan Gosling, and co-author of 7 Tom Clancy novels. You guessed it, the one and only Mark Graney. Talking about a packed year of the very best thriller writers in the world. I'm so lucky. And you can hear it all right here on thethrillerzone.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or most anywhere you enjoy your favorite shows. Be sure to subscribe, follow, and share. Until next week, finish up that holiday shopping, stay safe, and remember, you've got a friend right here. I'm David Temple, and we'll see you next time in the Thriller Zone.
The Thriller Zone has been presented by Blackstone Publishing and the exciting new techno-thriller 4 Minutes, now available from your favorite bookseller. Learn more at blackstonepublishing.com.